if you have a heart for this work, I know you talk to a lot of career changers, people that I know that say, hey, I'm interested in getting into the industry, but I don't know a lot about money. Money is the least important variable. If you're good with people, if you're honest, if you're trustworthy, the financial stuff you can learn very quickly. So I just want to encourage and embolden people who are listening to this. If you have a natural knack for connecting, if you care about helping people better themselves, the American Psychological Association measures the number one stressor in people's lives. The study's been around about as long as I have. I think it's about 40-something years old. Every single year, money is the number one stressor in people's lives. So this is a great career where you can make money, you can support your family, you can be professionally successful, but also help alleviate the number one stressor in people's lives. So don't worry about the financial stuff. That will come. It's easy to learn. The softer side, the human side, the relational side is much harder to coach. So if you've got that, come on, we need you.
Welcome, my friend, to the Conversations for Financial Professionals podcast. I'm your host, Dominique Henderson. And as a veteran of the financial services industry, I was curious to find out why, despite all the good that financial professionals do, that yet the term financial advisor would clear the room so fast at a dinner party. Why was this? And what was this gap between consumers of financial services and the providers of those services? In this podcast, I seek to close this gap by having forward-moving conversations to advance the profession of giving financial advice and provide tools to the next generation of financial professionals to serve their clients at the highest level. You see, as providers of financial services, we have the awesome privilege of partnering with consumers to help change family trees, normalize the creation of wealth, and help the industry as a whole do less harm and more good. So it's time to sit back and enjoy the conversation. In this episode of Conversations for Financial Professionals, we get to talk with Dr. Daniel Crosby about incorporating behavioral science into the financial professionals toolkit. In our convo, we talk about the elephant in the room. As we know, there's a very small percentage of the CFP curriculum that actually targets the psychology of financial planning. And so I'm interested to get Dr. Crosby's opinion on whether this is too small an amount. We also talk about the necessity of that topic for today's and tomorrow's financial professionals, and why you might be finding it difficult as a financial professional to get your clients to do the recommendations inside of the plans you create. We then transition our conversation to the three E's of behavioral change: education, environment, and encouragement, and how Dr. Crosby sees financial professionals preparing to make this journey within this framework with their clients. So much information and a wealth of wisdom inside of our talk. Now it's time to sit back and enjoy the conversation. Welcome to another episode of Conversations for Financial Professionals, where we are shaping the next generation of advice. And we got a good one here today, Dr. Dan Crosby. You are a psychologist and behavioral finance expert who helps organizations understand the intersection of mind and markets. I love it. Your first book, Personal Benchmark, Integrating Behavioral Finance and Investment Management, was a New York Times bestseller. Your second book, The Laws of Wealth, was named the best investment book of 2017 by the Axiom Business Book Awards and has been translated into 7 languages. Your latest work, The Behavioral Investor, is a comprehensive work in the neurology, physiology, and psychology of sound financial decision making. Welcome to the podcast, my friend.
Wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. When you want to talk about a topic like this, you got to stay in your own lane. So it's good to bring in a ringer. So you're a ringer in this regard. So I'm really happy to chop it up with you. Incorporating behavioral science into the financial professionals toolkit. A lot of people I talk to, and probably aspiring financial professionals you talk to also, want to do the CFP. So I just want to get the elephant in the room out the way. CFP is great. We all know it. We love it. What is your opinion about the amount of this particular topic that is currently in the curriculum?
Well, it's getting better. You know, we're headed in the right direction, and shout out to the CFP board for taking pains to move us in the right direction. So, you know, I've got a hammer, so I see behavioral nails everywhere. And so for me, if it were 50% behavior, that still might not be enough. But look, I think they're making strides in the right direction. I think it reflects the way that the industry is trending. And I got good things to say about the CFP with respect to how it sort of privileges the place of behavioral science. Maybe not quite enough, but we're headed in the right direction. So shout out.
No, I agree. I agree on the progress. As a matter of fact, they just upped it for this testing round, which we're in the, as we're recording this, we're in the testing window right now. What are some, if you will, just so we can kind of be frank here, what are some deficiencies that you are seeing? I don't know how closely you've studied the curriculum, but I know you know about behavioral finance, and I know you know that there's a counseling component in there and some other things. What are some areas that you would say that could be beefed up, if you will?
Well, I'll speak in general. I'm no expert in the CFP curriculum in specific, but you know, there's all these subgenres. So we've got behavioral finance, which I think a lot of people would at least popularly say is the study of these heuristics and biases, deviations from sort of expected utility with respect to how people make financial decisions. But then we've got financial therapy, right? Financial therapy is sort of this new emerging discipline, which is counseling couples when money gets in the way of a happy relationship, or counseling individuals, getting them to be aware of and cognizant of their money scripts, and counseling with respect to finances. So money touches every part of our lives, we know. And so what's a fascinating statistic that I like is that, you know, a quarter of all visits to a general practitioner get referred out to a psychologist. I think that something like 25% of all visits to a CFP will eventually get shipped out to a financial therapist, because money just touches every part of our lives. It's so central to so many of our other bigger concerns. So, you know, we've got to touch on the behavioral finance nitty gritty. How are we sort of defying expected utility, and what are some of the biases and decision-making traps that we fall into? But we've also got to have sort of the softer side of, you know, how do we counsel with people? When do we need to know to make a referral? When are we in over our heads? And so there's at least a couple of sort of sub-disciplines, even when we get into the behavioral science side of money.
I'm glad you said that, because there's a notion in our industry, unfortunately, that I think has persisted for way too long, which is like, you know, I work so hard to pull myself up by my bootstraps to build this business, and I definitely don't want to refer clients out the door because they may not stay, right? Which is maybe needs to be addressed as a scarcity mindset, but nonetheless, I think it makes it a little harder for what you just said to happen there with, hey, I'm a little bit over my skis here when it comes to this type of conversation. I probably need to bring a professional in that's more apt. Would your thought be, and I guess there's no right or wrong answer here, but how do you see this happening with existing firms to like bring in that specialist like on staff, or just have a referral network that you can, you know, kind of use these different expertises? What would be your thought there?
Yeah, I think in the case of very large shops, there's a place to have someone on staff. But I'd say for your average, you know, 1 to 5 person RIA, you don't have that sort of level of specialization. And it is a very specialized field with folks all over the country. You may not even have someone locally, depending on where you live. So it's going to be a referral out. And, you know, I'd say two things. First of all, a financial therapist is not going to take your AUM billing clients, right? It's a different animal. It's a different thing altogether. So there's no real competition there. And the second thing I'd show is that Robert Cialdini, the psychologist, did really fascinating work on the psychology of influence. And he found that, unsurprisingly, one of the things that causes people to be persuaded or influenced is they want to work with an authority figure. Well, we know that to be the case, but we also know that people have a strong sort of BS meter. And so when we purport to be good at everything, people kind of understand that that's not typically the case. I call it like the cheesecake factory phenomenon. You look at a cheesecake factory menu and go, you know, there's no way this can all be good, right? Like you can't you can't do sushi and pizza and tacos and steak and like
in the same kitchen.
Yeah, and have it all be good. So Cialdini shows that we're actually at our most authoritative when we're telling someone what we don't do well and then following it up quickly with what we do well. So we say, hey, look, it seems like you and your partner need to talk to someone about XYZ sort of financial therapy concern. I'm going to refer you over here to Dom or, you know, whoever it is. But for all of your, you know, for all of your financial planning and asset management needs, I'm your guy, I'm your gal. So I think it, paradoxically, we're scared of referring people out, but it's actually one of the ways that we build a lot of perceived influence in our clients' minds by just being upfront about what we do and don't do well.
No, I think you're right. I simply look at that as just having an abundance mentality. If you're doing really great work serving people, you should have more clients than you can serve, to be honest. Like you really should. I want to stay here for just a second and ask about this, you know, kind of principles of counseling. You mentioned therapy. We haven't really mentioned the word coaching. I think there are obviously different disciplines around financial planning, financial therapy, financial coaching, you know, financial counseling. I wonder what your thoughts are on that. And then maybe a follow-up question. Have you noticed this convergence of these topics into what we traditionally call financial advice?
Yeah, there is a convergence. And to be honest, some of these terms aren't protected and the lines are very gray. Right. I mean, even the term financial advisor is not protected. The term coach is certainly not protected. Even in the mental health side of things, you know, the term psychologist, you've got to be a clinician with a PhD to call yourself a psychologist. To call yourself a psychotherapist, you can be, you know, any old person and much less a life coach or something. So there is a ton of overlap. And I think in general, one of the simplest ways to think about it is sort of the depth or the severity of the need, right? I mean, the therapy is probably for a deeper and more ingrained problem set than coaching. But, you know, therapists are going to, in most instances, have a deeper and more substantial academic pedigree than a coach. Not always the case. But so there's a ton of overlap, but there is a bit of buyer beware there. To just make sure that the person you're talking to has the right set of credentials and a set of credentials that aligns with your needs, because unfortunately, there's so many service providers in financial services that all look the same from the outside and really aren't the same at all.
Well, and I was just talking about this with a colleague the other day, is there's not much, I hate to use this word, but really incentive for the financial industry to do much education to the consumer of financial services to help them differentiate, right? You know, you do have things like the CFP marks that help people say, if you want to work with somebody that can build a comprehensive financial plan for you, these people have been vetted in this particular type of way. And here are the, you know, type of check the list stuff that they did in order to get these. But by and large, I've always said this, the bar to call yourself a financial advisor is so low right now in the industry. I wonder why, you know, you wonder why people are confused about what we do.
You know, Dom, I had a friend of mine, a neighbor and a church friend, lost his wife recently. And so now he's had this, you know, this personal upheaval, and he's had this financial upheaval, and he's trying to get his house in order. And, you know, he called me the other day and he said, look, I've been approached by a couple of financial advisors, but they're all trying to sell me something. And he, you know, kind of went down the path. And I'm like, look, you've been You've been approached by salespeople. Like what you need is you've been approached by salespeople masquerading as financial advisors. You need someone who understands the depth and the complexity of your situation personally and financially. And that's not these people who have approached you. So yeah, there are definitely some perverse incentives from a financial standpoint for the industry, but we've got to do a better job of separating salespeople from deeply trained, embedded financial planners and folks who put client needs first.
Yeah, I'm glad you said it. It's a good segue to the next thing I wanted to talk about with you, which is this. I would have to say, especially in, you know, kind of comparison to other industries, and I'll give a couple examples here as I set up the question. Why we as an industry are so slow to adopt what obviously people are already adopting. Like, you know, we move fairly quickly from like public transportation to taxis to Uber, from moving into, you know, going to Walmart with my shopping cart to Instacart or grocery delivery. We still have the 1940 Investment Advisor Acts. I mean, like, really? Like, what's taking so freaking long? Like, do you have any thoughts about this?
Yeah, I do. I have some cynical thoughts. You know,
Go ahead.
I'm going to mess up the quote, but there's this great quote that, it, you know, effectively, it's hard to change a person's mind when their livelihood depends on their mind not being changed. And wow. The fact is, there's still a lot of people who make a lot of money from things that are not necessarily in client interests. These people have a substantial lobby. They have the money and the access and the power to make their voice heard in a way that sometimes sort of the good folks in our industry do not. And so I think it's that easy. I think a lot of people have been incentivized for a long time for doing the wrong thing. And it almost has to be a grassroots movement to educate investors to know what to ask for and to know what to look for. But I mean, that is tough. I mean, and that takes education, that takes time, that takes effort on the part of people like you and your platform. But I do think there's a groundswell. I do think investors are increasingly well educated with respect to what to look for. But look, there's a lot of old ways and means of doing things that have very deep pockets, and I don't imagine are going anywhere anytime soon.
No, I think I concur with you, and I think the hope. I also concur with your hope that we are looking at a more not only educated, because to me, information is really ubiquitous right now with just about everything you could, you know, search and Google and all this other kind of stuff, which can be a double-edged sword too. That's a whole other topic. But I think the point I'm making here is not only are they knowledgeable and educated, have access to information, but they're also demanding a certain level of service too. And I think that will hopefully change the tide a little bit quicker. Are those similar thoughts that you're kind of seeing now in the industry?
So there's this Accenture study that I just read a few weeks ago that I'm just obsessed with. It was asking clients what they're looking for in a financial advisor. The number one answer was someone who gets me. 91% said they want to work with someone who gets me. The number two answer was someone with whom I share values. And the number three answer was effectively like someone I can spend time with outside of the office. And so it's almost as those clients are looking for a buddy who happens to know a lot about markets and the way things work. But honestly, that's a very healthy way to view it. Like, I mean, it sounds a little bit soft, but I actually think all the research suggests that the value that's added by working with a planner or an advisor and the value is sizable. Most of that value loads on to sort of the behavioral and relational parts of the coin. And so at first, the results of this survey can feel a little bit soft. But I think if you think about it, I think clients are increasingly onto something. Like, I want a trusted voice in my life who can speak to the ins and outs of finance and help me at critical decision points. And like, that's it. That's what I want. And that's what they need.
It makes so much sense, though, because when you think about who your existing clients, and I'll just be really Frank, I have a client right now that I'm thinking about that brings to me ideas that he talked about with his buddies on the golf course.
Yeah.
And the reason why those ideas have such merit and are seeming it so hard in his mind is because he trusts those people. So, yes. And it's not to say he doesn't trust me. He just trusts them in a different way, obviously more intimately. And therefore he's thinking about their advice. And he's like, he's right past his financial advisor. So, you bring up a good point. Matter of fact, Gene Dunn of T. Rowe Price did a study on the next wave of wealth. And this, the Accenture study is kind of overlapping with what they're finding. Mm-hmm. As far as the behavioral dynamics of what people are requesting. And I just wonder, I don't know, it goes into something that this is really not part of what I was going to talk about, but I think it makes sense. Like, how well do you think our current landscape of financial professionals, kind of broad stroking this, is equipped with those soft, empathetic, bedside manner type of skills? Because I think there's some psychological work that you have to do, some self-work you have to do before you're ready to have that type of relationship with a client. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you make an underappreciated point there, I think, which is that there's some work that you need to do on yourself. So here's what I will say. I think the hearts of most financial professionals are in the right place. I really have observed that most people who go into this industry do so with a desire to help people, and they see it rightly as a helping profession. So that is an important first step, and I think that by and large, that is there. So once you have the heart for doing the work, I think that the next thing you need to do is that self-work. You know, it's no coincidence that when I was training to be a psychologist, the very first thing they do is give you your own psychologist and, you know, say, look, before we turn you loose with anyone, like, we got to clear the mess out of your own head, guy. You know, we got to get you out of your own way. And I do think there is a degree to which we can only help our clients. We can only bring our clients as far as we've gone ourselves.
Wow. And so you know, that's a soundbite. We got to mark that. Got to mark that.
Title. We got the title of the show now. So I think I think there is some real self work to be done there. And you know, when people read books like mine or the other great behavioral finance books out there, I think most people do so as a window onto other people's behavior. Like, you know, oh, like I read about this, like, yeah, that's totally my father-in-law. Like, that's totally my neighbor or whoever. Right. And like the first thing we need to do is hold that mirror up to ourselves. And then I think the third step is the actual skills, like, you know, the skills of having those conversations, the deep listening, all that stuff. So you think you got to have a heart for it. You got to figure your own mess out. And then you got to go get those sort of concrete skills. It's the rough 3-part process.
With all the distractions and things vying for your attention on a day-to-day basis, when do you have time to consider what your purpose is? Have you thought about what it is going to take to achieve your goals? After having dozens of conversations with clients, I decided to provide a simple framework on how you can answer those questions. That framework is contained in my book called Assess, Address, and Adjust, a practical guide to becoming unstuck and achieving your goals. Look, if you've ever felt that you're losing the time for money trade, and want to start winning in the next 30 days with real practical tips to improve your situation, or if you're not motivated to push through the day because you have a job you don't enjoy, a relationship you're ready to get out of, or just feel like you're not where you want to be in life, this book is for you, my friend. If you're ready to change that uncomfortable level of dissatisfaction that's currently going on in your life, and you want the tools to help you get unstuck, then head on over to domhendersonsr.com/theunstuckbook. Now, let's get back to the conversation. No, and it's amazing that I talk to career changer after career changer after career changer, and, you know, persons trying to scale their practice, really the career changer, and they get so wrapped around the axle about doing the books and stuff first. And I'm just like, I got my CFP after 15 years in the industry. A lot of experience, a lot of phone conversations, a lot of life that happened. I've been married 25 years this upcoming May. And I tell people all the time, you know, some of the best advice I think I've given to clients has been from being married 25 years and having 3 adult children. Because as you alluded to earlier, personal finance is so much more personal than finance.
It's really those, you know, those kind of those uncomfortable, icky places that we're not always taught to go to and just be, sitting in the uncomfortable silence and all this other kind of stuff. I want to unpack something you said earlier, though, when it comes to this kind of rough build, if you will, of a next generation financial professional, especially from this standpoint, is the notion around not being able to really give away to clients what you haven't done yourself. Do you have any maybe, you know, kind of quick tools or things that they should probably start to look at? Because it reminds, when you said that earlier about, that's really my father-in-law, it reminds me of like how people read the Bible, like, yeah, this is really so-and-so. No, it's meant for you. It's really meant for you to be looking introspectively right now, not your wife or not your spouse or something like that. So do you have anything that they could maybe start to go down that path if this is resonating with them?
Yeah, the Bible's got the whole bit about motes and beams, right? Like take it out of your own.
Exactly. Take it out of your
own eye where you look for someone else. Yeah. I think one of the most powerful things you can do, first of all, is to go to therapy, as I suggested. The other thing that I think you should do is you should have your own financial advisor. It's interesting to me, sort of the hypocrisy that exists in our industry. We preach the value of behavioral advice. And I mean, look, study after study after study, like the fundamentals of good investing and financial planning are so easy. Like if you really spent a weekend locked in your room reading a handful of good books about investing, you would come out with everything you need to know to beat 90% of active managers. It's not that hard. It doesn't take that long, right? But we spend all of our time on that and so little time on the behavioral stuff, which takes a lifetime and is much more difficult, but much more valuable. So if you believe that behavioral finance is the way that financial advisors add value, you need one too. Like I pay a financial advisor who, look, I mean, let me just be a little overconfident here. I probably know more about markets than he does, right? I mean, I've written 3 books on markets. I'm pretty dang good. But that's not why I need his help. I need his help because when it comes down to the nitty-gritty of investment decision-making, I'm just as fallible, I'm just as emotional, I'm just as short-term as the next person, and I can't write enough books to get out of that box.
Yeah.
And so every person, every advisor who believes in this stuff should go to therapy. You should have your own financial advisor. And then you should just read books, right? Read books like the behavioral finance canon, right? And look for how it applies to you and understand the ways that money shapes your own behavior. I think that's a very simple way to start.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't agree more. I think, man, interesting rabbit trails to hop down here. I think essentially what you're saying is it's hard to really do your clients the type of service that you want them to have, the transformation you're trying to get them to experience without first having sat in their shoes. Like it's really, really hard. I tell this every once in a while. When I first got into the business, I got my Life Health 766, and one of my mentors / managers was asking me how things were going. And I was like, so you start to diagram and diagnose and stuff. And he stopped me like mid-sentence as I'm kind of giving him, you know, how this prospect meeting went. He goes, wait, hold on. Have you purchased an insurance policy yet for yourself and your family? And I was like, no, I was going to get around to it. He's like, that's the problem. He's like, you're never going to be able to talk with conviction about anything you haven't done. And I was like, wow, that's true. So I was like, you know, one of the things that I kind of tell people is like, well, okay, tell me, okay, you can't afford a financial advisor, but where's your financial plan? Have you created a financial plan for your family? Oh, no. Well, how can you create a financial plan for other people and you haven't done it yourself? So excellent point. I want to transition to these 3 E's of behavioral change, this education, environment, encouragement. I think it's a really good rubric, not only for consumers of financial services, but inside the industry, too. How did you come up with this and how do you think it applies to this conversation with today's next generation financial professional we're talking about?
So I, you know, the short answer is I came to it through years of study and an obsession with coming up that with shorthands that rhyme or are alliterative. My coworkers all make fun of me. Everything's always got to be start with the same letter or rhyme. But you know, one of the things that we know is that behavior change is enormously difficult, and education is frankly just not enough. You know, there's very little relationship between knowing what to do and doing the right thing. You know, 40% of people cheat on their spouse. Not a single one of them is like, yeah, this is right. Like, this is good. Like, I'm doing what I should be doing, right? And we know doctors and nurses smoke at a rate that's nearly, in the case of nurses, nearly double the national average. And so these people who are so smart and so generous and spend all of their trying to heal us are doing something that's detrimental to their bodies at a clip of twice the population. So education is necessary, but not sufficient. That's that first E, that's that foundational piece. The next thing that we know from the behavioral science is that environment is highly, highly predictive of behavior. You know, this is, we in the West tend to have this idea that you know, Daniel at the store is the same as Daniel at church as Daniel in conversation with his wife. In the East and elsewhere in the world, they don't think this way. They think in more situational ways. And to be honest, that's much more reflective of the behavioral evidence that your decisions are usually about as good or as bad as the place you find yourself. So the environment with respect to financial decision making is really your portfolio. You need to have a portfolio that's not going to be so volatile that it's going to induce you to make bad decisions. And it also has to do with what you're putting in your head, right? Are you listening to the weekly markets and turmoil specials, or are you filling your head with different things? And then that last piece is the encouragement. That's where the advisor comes in. Research out of Canada was fascinating. Compared DIY investors to advised investors and normalized these two groups across 50 different variables to make sure that, you know, things like salary and things like that were equivalent. And they found that people who had a long-term relationship with a financial professional had like 2.7 times the wealth of those who had similar salaries but had gone it alone that whole time. And when you drill down, it's really about just three or four times during that person's life when the financial advisor was that last deterrent between them and a bad decision. It's March of 2020 when you're ready to hit sell on everything and lock in huge losses, but your advisor pleads with you to stay the course and you sit around and take the tremendous ride that's followed, right? So it's things like that. So we need to educate our clients. They need to know what to expect. We also need to put them in the right environment, which is, you know, there's a big difference between sort of mathematical optimal and behavioral optimal. We don't mean to maximize mean variance optimization. We need to maximize for sleep well at night. And then the last piece is we need to be there in times of struggle, you know, to keep them from making that critical wrong move. And when those three things are in place, you're going to get it right more often than not.
No, Carl Richards says something a long time ago that I heard, which is basically our job as financial professionals is to help people from doing stupid suboptimal things.
Yeah.
Right. Cause you know, like you mentioned about, you know, March 2020, and there's so many studies over the years that they've been collecting this, you know, markets data that missing just the first 10 days of a market rally just tremendously reduces your overall return. Like, yeah. And this whole thing about market timing, I can get in and I'll be able to get out when I need to and all that. I want to, you know, catch the bottom. And it's just, you know, having the discipline to hire somebody that would tell you this is not the best decision based on that. Because like you said, the heuristic in our own mind is going to be pretty lizard brained. Like I need to protect myself. Right. So I'm so glad you said that. I'm imagining in the seat that you sit in, you see a lot of different advisor avatars. if you were to kind of maybe draw out a couple of the skills, because people that listen to this would be like, you know, I want to be everything that, you know, Dr. Crosby and Dominique are talking about right now. I want to be that type of person for my clients. Matter of fact, a lot of the career changes that I talk to nowadays, they're more disenfranchised with working with a big name bank and more drawn into, I wouldn't call it altruistic necessarily, but they're definitely wanting to help their own community and things like that. And so these are skill sets that they're needing to develop. What are some of the maybe top things that you, looking at the landscape that you, you know, kind of see right now, would you say if you're starting to, you know, make a skill stack, visitor therapist, definitely hire a financial planner if you could, anything else that you would throw on top of that?
Yeah. You know, one of the best things that you can do is surround yourself by people who you'll be able to influence and people with whom you naturally connect. So one of the coolest and most sort of surprising pieces of literature from psychology is that psychologists with a bachelor's versus a master's versus a PhD, when you look at their patient outcomes, they're identical, right? So I don't know why I went to all this school, but like the outcomes, the outcomes are identical, right? You know, whether you have a 4-year degree or a 9-year degree. Mm. And so what they broke it down and found that the thing that was most predictive of whether or not people get better in therapy is the level of rapport between that person and the therapist. And so some of the most successful, there is no cookie cutter sort of mold for being a successful FA. But what I will say is the most successful FAs I know work with people who are like them on some dimension, right? They have some sort of affinity or natural connection. You know, it could be, a shared love of family. It could be, you know, folks from the same subcommunity, whatever it is. Again, going back to the Cialdini research, we know that we are influenced by people we like, and we know that we like people who are like us. And so I think a lot of the most successful advisors wouldn't fit sort of the mold you would think of. You know, some of them are quite introverted, some of them are quite shy or whatever. You wouldn't sort of think of as, oh, this is sort of the number one behavioral coaching type person in my mind. But what they've done is they've surrounded themselves by tight-knit groups of clients who like and trust them and listen to them. And when that rapport is in place, a lot goes right. So, you know, find clients that value the same things you do, remembering from that Accenture study that it's the second most important thing they're looking for. Think that's a good place to start.
No, it reminds me of the work done by Stephen Covey way back in the day, the speed of trust. Like there's so many things that can happen relatively quickly when there's trust on both sides. And when it's when there's an imbalance, you know, you find your clients not returning your phone calls or your text or whatever, and you're like, I really want them to do this. You might want to evaluate the relationship, whether or not they trust you or not. And that might be just a really hard conversation to have, because I think you make a lot of really great points, which going back to the top of this, you know, kind of pains me to see, you know, I've looked at in my line of work, I've looked at I think there's 180 financial designations on the FINRA website right now, and not many of them go into a lot of the stuff we've been talking about. This has almost kind of been like a masterclass on the psychology of this stuff. And I tell aspiring financial professionals and the advisors that I coach now, like, do yourself a favor and incorporate into your reading diet, not just financial, you know, magazines and stuff like that. Like, read other stuff, specifically psychology and how humans think, because this is going to be such a great asset to your practice. So,
yeah.
Great stuff. Great stuff, man. Well, as you know, this is a podcast to help empower tomorrow's financial professional with tools to serve their client at the next level. And I wonder, with that in mind, what word or words of wisdom would you like to leave with the audience?
Yeah. If you have a heart for this work, I know you talk to a lot of career changers, people that I know that say, hey, I'm interested in getting into the industry, but I don't know a lot about money. Money is the least important variable. If you're good with people, if you're honest, if you're trustworthy, the financial stuff you can learn very quickly. So I just want to encourage and embolden people who are listening to this. If you have a natural knack for connecting, if you care about helping people better themselves, the American Psychological Association measures the number one stressor in people's lives. The study's been around about as long as I have. I think it's about 40 something years old. Every single year, money is the number one stressor in people's lives. So this is a great career where you can make money, you can support your family, you can be professionally successful, but also help alleviate the number one stressor in people's lives. So don't worry about the financial stuff. That will come. It's easy to learn. The softer side, the human side, the relational side is much harder to coach. So if you've got that, come on, we need you.
Yes, I couldn't underscore that any more than what you said. It is so, so, so very true. And it's, I think people that look at that as a privilege to sit in that seat in someone's life. There's been so many client stories I've had. I'll tell this real quick one, but you know, the husband wasn't as drawn into the relationship as the wife was. And I remember him popping into one of our meetings, and he was like, just have to say this real quick. Matter of fact, it was his birthday. He was like, just have to say this real quick. The work that you've done with us, and specifically my wife, since we've been working together, he's like, I've seen the stress like lift off her life. And he's like, I just want to thank you. And I was like, wow, thank you. That's like one of the highest compliments I've ever gotten. And that was it. Shot me the deuces and went about his business. But I think to your point, people understand that this is one of those topics, money, that they may not know always the best choices and have the best choices. And they realize there's a lot at stake and they want help. And so to echo your words, if that's you and you want to help people, we need you. We definitely need you. Daniel Crosby, oh my gosh, such a treat to talk to you. We're going to have you back at some point because I know there's a lot more in that well that you drew from today.
Yeah, happy to do it, man. Thanks all for right. having me.
Great. Thank you for the deposit. Appreciate you. Bye-bye.
Take care.
I really hope you enjoy this conversation. Before we go, just a few things. The best way to retain what you just learned is to do more than just listen. You first might want to write down your most important takeaway and then give yourself a deadline to apply it. For bonus points, you might also let someone hold you accountable to that deadline. And remember, the only way more people will know about this podcast is if you share it. You can do that by sharing a link to this episode on your social media or by leaving a review on iTunes so that it reaches a wider audience. I'd appreciate it if you took the time to do either or both. And finally, if you'd like to learn more about how Jumpstart can help you become a next generation financial professional or partner with you in finding next generation talent for your organization, send us an email at hello@jumpstartcoachinglab.com, just in case you needed to get a pen to write that down. That's hello@jumpstartcoachinglab.com. Bye for now until our next conversation.